We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by George Beebe. He's the director of grand strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. George spent more than two decades in government as an intelligence analyst, diplomat, and policy advisor, including as director of the CIA's Russia analysis and as a staff advisor on Russia Matters to Vice President Cheney. His book, The Russia Trap, How Our Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe, which was released in 2019, warned how the United States and Russia could stumble into a dangerous military confrontation, much like the situation we face over Ukraine today. Sir, that book seems to have been very prescient, and I know we will get into all of that, but if you could start just by walking us through your career, you've worked in some pretty incredible places, that would be fantastic.
Oh, well, thanks, Emily, and thanks for having me on the show. Well, you know, my career was largely accidental. I stumbled into it, not according to any plan. I lived in the Marshall Islands when I was a teenager. My father worked for a research laboratory that was involved in building and operating radar installations on Kwajalein Atoll, which is where the United States tests its intercontinental ballistic missiles. And this was during the Cold War period, and the Soviet Union had an intelligence collection ship that would patrol off the shores of the lagoon into which these missiles were test fired. And I got interested in, you know, what this Cold War was all about. What about this arms race? What is the Soviet Union? And, you know, my friends and I would go off scuba diving and fishing and wave to the people on that Soviet ship, and they would wave back. And I decided, gee, you know, I'd look into this, took some classes in college, and wound up in graduate school running into a guy who was teaching one of my classes who used to work at the CIA. And he said, you know, hey, you ought to look into working as a CIA analyst, which took me completely by surprise, having no other plans about what I might do for a career. I thought, well, what the heck, might be an interesting experience. And things sort of went from there. And I ended up having, I think, a very productive and, you know, quite a fulfilling career in the intelligence community. And I got the opportunity to do some very interesting rotations to the State Department in our embassy in Moscow and in Vienna on the U.S. delegation to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Got involved in some conventional arms control negotiations and wound up at the White House and on Vice President Cheney's staff. And so I've had a very interesting perspective on what has happened since the end of the Cold War up through the present time. And it's really been quite a ride.
That seems to be an understatement. You've written a trove of interesting pieces over the course of this sort of Ukraine crisis. And you've also analyzed the sort of Russiagate hoax through the lens of your experience as an intelligence analyst. And I want to get into all of that. But I think a good place to start might be just with your book released in 2019, again, called The Russia Trap, How Our Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe. What were you looking at then that sort of proved to be true over the last couple of months?
Well, what prompted that book was a call from a publisher who asked me if I would be interested in writing about what he called the U.S.-Russia gray war or hybrid war that was getting a lot of attention back in those days. And I said, well, you know, I'm flattered that you're interested, but no, thank you. He said, why not? And I said, well, I don't think I'd write the book that I think you're asking for. And he said, well, what would you write? And I made the mistake of answering him. he said, well, you know, write that. And so I said, okay. But the argument that I made to him and what I elaborated on in the book was that I thought that the United States was in the middle stages of an escalation spiral with Russia. where a variety of different factors were coming together and reinforcing one another to put us on a path toward a very dangerous direct confrontation between the United States and Russia. And I had seen over the course of my career a lot of events that people hadn't expected that took us by surprise. Starting with the breakup of the Soviet Union, through the failure of domestic democratic reforms inside Russia itself in the 1990s, through a series of what we called then color revolutions in the former Soviet Union, and culminating in the Maidan revolution in Ukraine and Russia's, quite vehement and in Washington unexpected response to that, which included the annexation of Crimea and the start of an all but overt war in Ukraine's eastern regions in the Donbass. And my point in the book was that what was going on here was an escalatory spiral that neither the United States nor Russia really recognized. And that unless we took action to find a way to arrest that escalation, that it would continue. And the intent of the book was really to warn people so that they could take that kind of action that would prevent this spiral from continuing to escalate. And unfortunately, I think my analytic part of the book, identifying what was going on so that people could understand where this might be headed, proved accurate. The warning part of the book, which is intended to get people both in Russia and in the United States to take action to avert this collision, failed. And we are where we are right now, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I was reading something you had written sort of about the structural problems, actually in both the media and in the intelligence community, that informed problems around Russiagate and actually around Iraq. But how do you think some of those structural problems are maybe affecting this particular conflict, especially in the early days of it? It seemed like particularly the information war and the intel war was, heading in perhaps similar directions.
Well, one of the factors in this escalatory spiral, and there are many of them involved, that is reinforcing other factors and making it more difficult to understand what's going on and take effective action, is what you might call a battle of narratives that's been going on. And this is affecting perceptions in the United States of Russia and its intentions, and it's affecting perceptions in Russia of the United States and our intentions. And the media, unfortunately, is exacerbating this problem. It did that in Russiagate, I think, where there were very, very few voices that said, wait a minute, are there alternative ways of understanding what's going on here? Is there a skepticism that we need to be applying to the narrative that the mainstream media is promulgating on all of this? And what are the implications of getting this one wrong? What we had, I think, during that Russiagate hoax was an intense demonization of not just Putin, but Russia and Russians. And we came, I think, to the conclusion that the Russians were out to not just compete with us for influence in Europe and other parts of the world, that this wasn't just a great power competition, as we experienced to a great degree during the Cold War, but that Russia was actually out for American blood, that they had the United States and its domestic political situation in their crosshairs, and that they hoped essentially to destroy the United States, not by using nuclear weapons or other military tools of combat, but by subverting us within, by turning Americans against one another, exacerbating the political and social divides that we had in this country in a way that would prove fatal to the United States. Simultaneously, in Russia, the perception took root that the United States had Russia in its crosshairs, not just that we wanted to compete for influence in key parts of the world, not just that we wanted to show that our system of government was more effective than that of Russia's, and to compete in that marketplace of ideas, but that the United States actually wanted to surround Russia with hostile military allies, enemies to Russia, whose ultimate goal was to break up the Russian Federation, to marginalize Russia as a player in the world, and ultimately to change Russia's regime from within. To topple Putin from power and install some sort of pro-Western leadership that would ensure that Russia was neutered, so to speak, in this relationship with the United States. And that, of course, was profoundly threatening to Russia. So the media narratives in the United States and in Russia, I think, have contributed greatly to these, what I think are deadly perceptions on the part of each side about the other side's intentions. That has made diplomacy, our ability to manage this relationship with Russia, to keep it within acceptable bounds, much, much more difficult than it would otherwise be.
Yeah, and I found what you've written on this to be fascinating. Did you actually, it sounds like you actually lived in Moscow.
I did briefly, yes, when I was on rotation to the State Department.
What years would that have been?
1995 and 1996.
Okay. All right, think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than in our cars or in our beds. That's why it's so important to invest in the right chair so that you're spending those hours with the right level of support and comfort so that you can get the most productivity out of your day. When you think about it, we do spend so much time worrying about our mattresses and our cars and not our chairs. But X-Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly my favorite place to sit for any reason. So not only does X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar or DVL offer the ultimate customized support, but my X-Chair can even give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. Now, all these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort, and that's why I love my X-Chair. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, Chair, FederalistCom, or call 1-844-4X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. XChairFederalist.com. And could you tell us, I mean, not a lot of Americans, a lot of Americans will go to London or other places in the world, but not a lot end up actually as tourists or in Russia for other reasons. Can you tell us what, you know, in those years that are sort of following what we think of as the end of the Cold War, what the sort of mood in Moscow and in Russia was like at the time that you were living there?
Well, I think immediately after the Soviet Union broke up into its constituent republics, Russia went through a trauma. There was a great deal of emotional shock at the loss of the Soviet entity. And there was a great deal, I think, of economic deprivation. Russia deindustrialized over the course of the 1990s. Much of the industry that the Soviet Union created collapsed. It ceased producing things. A lot of that was military industry, which, you know, lost its purpose and did not have commercial markets that it could pivot toward during that time. A lot of the Soviet people, the Russian people, in the aftermath of the breakup, lost their life savings. The ruble inflated to such a degree that bank accounts in rubles that held a substantial amount of money saved over the course of these people's lives suddenly became worth pennies. There was essentially a social revolution where many of the people who were at the top of the social hierarchy in the Soviet Union, scientists and engineers and government officials, teachers, suddenly found themselves on the bottom of the social ladder because they weren't making a lot of money. The institutions and factories that they were working for or leading collapsed. And many of the people who were most unscrupulous in Russia rocketed to the top because they were able to get their hands, either illegally or unethically, on enormous wealth. And this, as you can imagine, was quite a psychological trauma for a lot of Russians. And when you would walk the streets of Moscow or St. Petersburg during this period, I think people generally looked to be more or less in shock. A lot of blank faces. People would walk around, it appeared, aimlessly. Now, that changed, I think, over time. And when you would travel in Russia and visit Moscow and St. Petersburg, in the past, 10, 15 years, it was a much different place. Russia has had a boom in building, a lot of oil wealth, natural gas wealth, other commodities wealth has flowed into Russia's major cities. There's been a booming consumer class, a lot more wealth and prosperity. Home improvement has become, quite popular over there. It's a different place. Moscow in 1992 was a gray, drab, lifeless and joyless place. By 2015, it was a thriving European capital. Now, where Russia will go from here is anybody's guess, but I don't think under the current circumstances, its future looks anywhere near as bright as it did 5, 10, 15 years ago.
It must have been sort of odd working on, not even odd, but just an interesting challenge working on Russia issues in the aftermath of 9/11 for the Bush administration. And President Bush sort of famously said he felt he looked into Putin's soul. What was it like at that time, as the country's interest shifted reasonably to the Middle East, to be working on Russia issues, as that sort of 10 years post the fall of the Soviet Union was, upon the world and geopolitics at the time?
Well, Putin at that time was still relatively new to the Russian presidency. He had big ambitions for Russia. Russia had collapsed in a way that was almost unprecedented in the depth and speed of that collapse during the 1990s. Putin was determined to restore Russia to prominence on the international stage, not by becoming the great power in the world, but by becoming one of the world's great powers, sitting more or less, to use a metaphor, at the table of the world's board of directors. And he believed that the best way to get there, of course, was to have a good relationship with the world's foremost power. It was a unipolar world. The United States had no peer or near peer rivals at that time. And if you were going to be someone, you had to have a close relationship with the United States. And Putin pursued that, I think, quite energetically. He not only was the first person to call President Bush in the aftermath of the attacks on 9/11, 2001, he had actually called Bush a few days before those attacks to warn him that Russian intelligence had picked up a plot coming out of Afghanistan that he thought could have profound implications for the United States and broader world security. He didn't have enough specifics to say, you know, this is what's going to happen and here's who's going to do it and when. So it wasn't really actionable for us. But I think it does indicate that he sincerely wanted a cooperative and constructive relationship with the United States. And not that long thereafter, he actually raised the prospect of Russia joining NATO. He dismantled a very significant Russian intelligence collection facility in Cuba at the time. He also withdrew the Russian Navy from the naval base at Cam Ranh Bay in Vietnam, which was a highly symbolic act. You know, when the United States ended the Vietnam War and left Cam Ranh Bay, which we had built, the Soviet Navy cozied right in there. And the Russians, of course, as the successors to the Soviet Union, took that base over. So these were steps that I think he meant as very strong signals to the United States about the kind of relationship that Russia wanted with us. He also was very helpful in providing intelligence on terrorist threats, particularly in Afghanistan, and in facilitating the establishment of U.S. military bases in Central Asia that we could use in Afghanistan. So this was a period of time where the Bush administration actually was trying to work quite diligently on building a strategic partnership with Russia that would help us fight against what we regarded as a common threat, which was terrorism, Al-Qaeda, and other forms of terrorism in the world. Obviously, that didn't work out the way anybody hoped.
Right. So you've written recently, put bluntly, the very institutions that once served as bulwarks against error now advertised, amplified, and exploited fraudulent reports. And then you go on to say, consider the duplicitous Iraqi defector curveball, whom German intelligence sources regarded with skepticism, but American officials did not. His bogus accounts of Iraq's biological weapons labs were at the heart of Secretary of State Colin Powell's lamentable address to the UN Security Council. Professional standards that normally safeguard the integrity of journalism and intelligence work were cast overboard as so much useless. And by the way, I just want to say, this is you're also writing about this in the context of the Steele dossier. You say earlier in that same paragraph, intelligence community leaders helped to legitimize rather than debunk the invented Steele dossier. So I'm curious as to what your experiences in the Bush administration after 9/11, did this problem sort of intersect with your work in the Bush administration? And then how is it the case that in 2016, so many years later, the same structural problems seem to perhaps be even worse?
Well, what I experienced in the Bush administration was that there were a lot of very sincere, very well-intentioned people that fell victim to, I think, a massive case of confirmation bias. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of fear that, you know, as Condi Rice, I think, put it at the time, that, you know, we might see a mushroom cloud mm-hmm. that resulted from, you know, Iraqi-sponsored terrorists getting their hands on a nuclear device in some way and using that against the United States. And, you know, that fear was so great that we believed we needed to err on the side of overinterpreting bits of intelligence reporting that may not have very solid sourcing. But we didn't feel like we could take the risk that they might be right and wind up in an enormously destructive catastrophe as a result. And so some of the, you know, methodological requirements that you would normally employ to make sure you have high confidence in the veracity of intelligence conclusions weren't adhered to as scrupulously as they should have.
Mm.
And you know, we should have learned some lessons for that. And the kinds of things that you would employ as an intelligence analyst to separate truth from allegation, fact from rumor, are also a lot of the same principles that good journalists should be employing, where you're not just, you know, serving as a stenographer to sources and reporting things that people claim, but you're actually subjecting them to some sort of scrutiny in an objective sense, asking questions like, you know, how confident can we be that this source doesn't have an agenda? Are there other bits of information that tend to reinforce or confirm what these claims are? Are there contradictory reports that are out there that we need to assess in conjunction with what we're hearing here? And unfortunately, I think my impression has been that within the journalistic community, old standards that have been, you know, well honed over the decades to guard against these sorts of problems are not being applied today in the way that they should be. Now, part of what happens as a result of that, of course, is you get reporting that turns out to be erroneous in retrospect. And I think the Russiagate case is a prime example of that. But also, the more that that happens, the more that audiences, readers, start to doubt everything. They start to think, you know, I can't trust anything anybody says on any of this. That's a very dangerous situation, in my opinion, because the functioning of the American democratic system depends so heavily on the connection between voters, information, and our elected representatives. And if our citizens really profoundly start to doubt the veracity of what the media and other governing institutions are saying, that's really alarming. And I unfortunately, I think that's where we have been heading for several years.
Mm. I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set, regularly $109.99, for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza dream sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Yeah, it's really interesting. And as you can tell, I've been reading a lot of your recent work in preparation for this conversation. And I'm curious as to how that very problem is affected by, as you write about, the advent of the cyber age. You say it has made the chances of escalation into direct East-West conflict much greater than during the Civil War, while doing little to reduce its potential destructiveness. Our dependence on nearly defenseless digital infrastructure makes the United States far more vulnerable to foreign attacks than it was was only a few decades ago. Putin has publicly warned that Western economic sanctions constitute war against Russia. And then you ask this question, how might we react if Russian cyber combatants retaliate by disabling American power plants or disrupting trades on Wall Street? So on the sort of digital side, I imagine that has made an intelligence analyst's work more difficult. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but it seems like it would be a great way to sort of obfuscate and, you know, muddy the waters. And then at the other, on the other hand, I'm also curious as to how, if you could flesh out this argument about how it's made the chances of escalation much greater, as you say, than during the Cold War.
Well, during the Cold War, if we were going to spy on the Soviet Union, there were, you know, several basic ways we could do that. One is by trying to convince Russians or Soviets themselves to become spies on our behalf and to report on what they were seeing and hearing inside, you know, the secret corridors of the Kremlin. So that's what they call, you know, human intelligence. We could also gather various technical signals of different kinds, you know, eavesdrop on conversations, phone conversations, try to pick up on electronic signals inside the Soviet Union that would give us clues about how Russian military weaponry was performing and its capabilities. But in doing those things, it was very clear to people on the other side who were the recipients of this spying on our part, that this was in fact espionage, that this was not a military attack on the Soviet Union. What has happened with the advent of the cyber age is that there's now a new way that you can spy. You can intrude into computer networks and start to read people's emails and map out computer systems to understand what kind of data is flowing through them and how and what they're connected to. And this is a tremendously rich source of information that intelligence agencies can collect and analyze. And everybody in the world is doing it, including the Russians, who I think are quite good at this. But the difficulty with this form of espionage is that it is entirely unclear to somebody who's on the receiving end of this what the ultimate intentions of the intruders are. So if I'm monitoring a computer system here in the United States, and I see the presence of somebody who's not authorized to be there, first of all, I'm probably immediately not clear on who this is, and it takes a little bit of work to figure out exactly who the intruder is and where it's coming from. But I will also realize that once this intruder is in my system, he can collect data. In other words, he can engage in espionage of some kind, but he can also sabotage that system. He can use malware to throw a monkey wrench into the way that system works, either to disable it or disrupt it or to distort its operations in some way, and to sabotage the systems that are connected to that network. So, you know, when you consider that almost anything that matters in the United States right now is connected in some way to the internet, and things that aren't connected to the internet are still operated by computer systems, even if those computer systems are air-gapped, as they put it, from the internet. Really talented cyber attackers can still get access to all of that. And in a crisis, if you realize that there's somebody in a network that is quite sensitive, that really matters, that's connected in some way to critical infrastructure on which the United States economy depends, or to intelligence and reconnaissance systems that help protect us, give us warning of foreign attacks, or military communications, command and control systems that affect what our weapons can do. And you don't know whether their intention is to collect data or information about what we can do or might be doing, or actually to prevent those systems from operating. Well, that becomes profoundly destabilizing in the context of a crisis. If we're in a virtual state of war with Russia, as we are right now over Ukraine, and we suddenly find, you know, Russian cyber intruders inside a very sensitive U.S. system of some kind, we're probably not going to be complacent about what their intentions are. We may well assume a worst case intention on their part, that they intend to take down that system in some way. In the context of a crisis, that means that we may decide that we need to preempt whatever it is we fear the Russians might do. That's how escalation can happen under these circumstances. And it's why what's going on with Ukraine, at least a big part of why what's going on in Ukraine, is so dangerous.
It really does put it into perspective, and I think in a context a lot of people don't maybe consider. You've also written recently, after the near disaster of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Cold War was played according to a set of mutually accepted rules that helped to manage and stabilize the East-West rivalry. The two sides had widely divergent political ideologies, values, and national interests, but they shared a common recognition that in the nuclear age, war between them would be catastrophic for both, and therefore they had no choice but to establish rules of the game and draw security red lines neither would cross. Nearly all the Cold War era arms control and crisis management accords have disappeared. So with that sort of, with that as fact established, what would you like to see from the Biden administration going forward in this sort of cultural context, where you also write there has been no significant American constituency for any kind of detente with Moscow for at least a decade? What would you like to see from Biden in the days, weeks, and months ahead?
Well, I do think that we need some rules of the game to manage this relationship with the Russians that right now is so precarious, so vulnerable to spiraling out of control. The Biden administration started to do that in its first year in office in 2021. They, I think, quite wisely indicated that they wanted to make the relationship with Russia stable and predictable. And I think they understood that to do that, we needed to talk with the Russians about what the rules of the game were. And they did make some headway, I think, in that regard. They started initially to talk about a successor treaty to the New START Accord on strategic nuclear weapons. They launched a dialogue on cyber rules of the game, which, as far as I understood, actually started to make some progress. All that got derailed by Ukraine. And unfortunately, from the Russian perspective, one of the big rules of the game that they thought was critically important for Russian security was this notion of NATO enlargement. The advance that had been going on for several decades of the NATO alliance toward Russia's borders, and in particular, the prospect of either official Ukrainian membership in the NATO alliance or some quite substantial U.S.-Ukrainian military partnership, those were, I think, absolute red lines for the Russians. And they wanted to reach an understanding with the Biden administration that that was out of bounds. Now that, I think, is a rule that the Russians thought was critical that the United States said we were not willing to discuss. Biden, after his video summit meeting with Putin in early December of last year, left that meeting and announced quite publicly that he did not and would not respect any so-called Russian red lines on Ukrainian membership in NATO. And that's the point, I think, at which this began to fall apart. Now, the Cuban Missile Crisis was interesting in that a couple of things followed that near-miss crisis. One was the United States and Soviet Union both looked into the abyss, if you will, realized that they didn't want to come close to such a disaster again. And a long period of arms control measures and stabilization measures between the Soviet Union and the United States ensued, which worked fairly well. But there was also an informal understanding that emerged from that crisis. And that was that encroaching into what each side regarded as its very sensitive neighborhood, putting threatening weaponry on the borders of the other side was simply too dangerous for either side to tolerate. And an unwritten rule, I think, emerged that we weren't going to, attempt to roll back Soviet influence, in the border on the border of the Soviet Union in the Warsaw Pact. That was simply too provocative and risky to do, and that Russia likewise would not challenge the United States in that kind of manner. Trying to put military weaponry, particularly offensive military weaponry, inside what the United States regarded as its sphere of influence. So we had an unwritten understanding there. And the Russians believe that the United States no longer adheres to that unwritten understanding, that we have decided, we're going to expand NATO right into Russia's most sensitive neighboring regions, and that we had the right to do that, and that the Russians had no legitimate basis for objecting. I don't believe that's a sustainable situation. The Russians have shown they are willing to go to war to prevent that, and I don't think that's going to change. So if we're going to find some sort of new set of rules that can contain the dangers that exist right now, between Russia and the United States, we're going to have to return to discussion of what the rules of the game are going to be. And that means we're going to have to make some painful compromises. And right now, I'm not sure that either side is willing to make those sorts of painful compromises. Hopefully, this situation does not get so out of hand that we're not never able to return to that very important discussion.
And just in the course of the next year, we're looking at other countries seeking kind of immediately to leap into NATO. And that, creates a decision, when it comes to Finland for countries like the United States. And if you were talking to a sort of Finnish or even a Ukrainian proponent of NATO membership for their country and their people seeking that sense of protection, what would your, counter argument be? Or what would you tell someone in that situation who genuinely sort of craves what they think would be that protection from NATO? They're afraid of Putin. They're afraid of, nuclear conflict themselves. And they think joining NATO is the best option. How do you respond to that?
Well, a couple of ways. First of all, NATO is a defense commitment that the United States has that obligates us to consider an attack on one NATO member as an attack on the United States. So when we agree to bring new states into the NATO alliance, the United States is committing itself to the possibility of going to war in defense of that country. So you have to ask, does the admission of this particular new NATO ally advance the security of the United States? Or could we be getting ourselves into a situation much like what happened to European states in the prelude to World War I, where alliance commitments, defense commitments, actually led to a spiral of confrontation that put everybody in danger? It increased the risks of war rather than decreased them. And I think we have to consider that wars happen not just because somebody wakes up one day in another country and says, you know what, I like the territory that's over there across my border. It would look really good if it were inside my borders. I think I'm going to use my military to go and get that. Certainly that happens in the war in the world, but that's not the only way that wars start. Sometimes wars start because countries that take what they believe are defensive measures to protect themselves against attack and invasion actually wind up with defensive postures that other countries regard as threatening to them. Then you get into international relations theorists call the security dilemma, where, you know, to use a very crude analogy, you know, if an individual American citizen decides he's going to amass, you know, an arsenal of weaponry in his home that causes his neighbors to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I don't feel very comfortable with this guy, you know, having that kind of capability next door. Well, that happens between countries too. And I think we're in a situation right now where NATO has expanded to such a significant degree into geographic areas that are, for the Russians, uncomfortably close to them, that the Russians have said, hey, wait a minute, we don't feel comfortable with this extremely capable and extremely large alliance, you know, sitting a few hundred miles from Moscow, and we don't trust your intentions. So, you know, what I think we need to be doing and what I think potential new NATO members need to consider is that NATO has to make sure that it is respecting this delicate balance between defending itself and inadvertently threatening other countries. And that's, I think, what has happened over the past couple of decades. The Russians have said, wait a minute, this is just getting too close for comfort. We don't accept that Georgia, Ukraine, other countries that until very recently were part of, you know, what was the Soviet Union, if they become part of NATO, we don't feel secure. We feel threatened. We've got to find some way of handling that. Right now, we're not willing to have that discussion. And we seem to be going in a different direction of saying, you know, not only do we not accept the legitimacy of your concerns, but Russia itself is going to have to change fundamentally and perhaps have a different leadership. Otherwise, we can't talk to you. And that's, I think, a very dangerous situation.
George Beebe is the director of grand strategy at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's written some extremely helpful stuff on all of these difficult topics. We really appreciate your time today, George.
Thanks for having me, Emily.
Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
The flowers in the vase that you bought today. Stay.